Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age.
Welcome to Work is Weird Now podcast. Today we have Paul Lambert with us. Paul is on the faculty of Henley Business School and is the founding director of Living Work Consulting, which partners with clients to deliver innovative, human-centric solutions to real-world people and organizational challenges. He recently published a book called Alive, Cultivating Living Organizations for Success in a Digital Age. And so we're going to spend this time with him exploring the question, how can organizations liberate people and not constrain them? So welcome, Paul. It's nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Alice.
So first of all, just to dive straight into your book, which is called Alive, which is funny. Every time I type it in to read about it, I type my own name, which is obviously Alice. And you can see the sort of the inbuilt habits that guide our day to day. But so your book Alive suggests organizations can be living, evolving organisms. So when you think about our core question, how can organizations liberate people and not constrain them? Like, where do you start with an organization to do that?
Where do I start? I mean, one thing I was going to infer actually is Alive suggests that organizations can be dying as well. You know, like any living organization, any living being, there's that sense of growth, development, but also stagnation and potential decay. So where do you start? I think you start with the fact that we kind of the common experience of most people who've spent a few years in work is they've worked in places that have been wonderful, liberating. They felt alive, and people have also been in places where they go, they feel like a cog in a big wheel. I remember a friend talking about working for a very big professional services firm and just looking across the landing at 800 people all beavering away, not really talking to each other across this massive landing and just kind of thinking, I don't want to work here. There were some good things in that organization, some bad things, but one of the things was, most of all, it felt like being a very small cog in a very, very big wheel. So I start with the fact that if organizations are full of people, then organizations show a lot of characteristics like people, just like teams do, even communities, cities, etc. You know, they're living places. And yet, I think the sadness and probably the driving force behind me writing this book was that we haven't always felt like that. I've heard people say, this job is killing me, which is a very interesting expression. So I think workplaces should be liberating. It's just that keying into that human emotion that we want to go to work and feel alive, and organizations should be alive.
And so what do we mean when we say the words living organization, and how is that different from the way that many organizations are set up today?
Well, I think to link back to a theme I've heard through a lot of your podcasts is, first of all, a living organization is purposeful. So, you know, when we get up in the morning, part of what gets us up, what motivates us to do things like this, is that we feel a sense of purpose or mission in the world, or at least a reason for sort of going to that office or going somewhere or doing something. So I think first and foremost, a living organization has a keen sense of its purpose, just like a person who's truly alive has a keen sense of what they've got to do in the world, what they've got to give to the world, their part in perhaps a bigger story. So purpose is the number one. And then there's the expression of purpose. And I talk in the book really about the cognitive, the mind stuff, the kind of, you know, all that kind of, all those great ideas we bring to mind. So if I take a real life example, my friend Dave, who I think loves being a coach. He's a coach at work. He's a coach in his local football team. He's coached his son running. He has a real sense of purpose around releasing potential in people. He communicates very well the knowledge about getting better. He also brings a kind of a physical kind of to it. You know, he gets some training, but he understands how to use the physical environment, the structures around him to train people and to be a trainer. Last of all, the kind of emotional and I would say organizational over the cultural thing, which is, what is a developmental environment? what does it sound like? Do you encourage people? Do you blame people when they make mistakes? So you can see how quickly that translates to an organizational setting where if we want great places to work, then they've got to be places where we have a sense of purpose, a sense of mission. You know, like Patagonia will say, is there to make, to sustain and look after the earth. You know, we can buy into that as a mission statement. But what does that look like in structural stuff, the way we do business, the processes, the systems? What does that look like in terms of the knowledge, the insight that we bring to it? And finally, what's the culture of that? You know, that, you know, people always think first is, you know, am I wasting things? Am I doing an ultimate good here? What's the mindset behind that? So I think it's going to be mirrored at all those levels. And you see the mirror, the personal level, the team level, the organizational level. And I even, towards the end of the book, talk about ecosystems and how we have purpose, not just within our organization, but working with others. There's a lovely organization we went traveling with called Intrepid. I don't know whether you've come across it.
Oh, is it travel? They do travel packages.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, I have seen it. Yeah.
We went to Vietnam with them, but the founders set out, and I'm afraid in that chapter of the book, there's a few pictures of us on holiday as well, but it was a fantastic holiday, but it was, they do things with local guides, local groups, to make things sustainable. We had a kind of jungle stay as part of that with local families, but they have sort of embedded not only that sense of purpose and mission in their own organization, but in the way they work with partners. So that's what, hopefully I'm giving you a sense of what I see as kind of a living organization.
I want to talk about what's happened at Liverpool Football Club with Diogo Jota, because that for me is very much culture. So I'm from Liverpool. The accent's diluted quite a bit now, but I'm a Liverpool fan. I wouldn't say I'm a fanatic in any way. But when that accident happened, I was hysterical. I cried for days. And my husband was like, oh my God, are you okay? And somebody from home put a post on Instagram and just said, it felt like we knew him. We felt like he was a friend, right? And the culture that Liverpool Football Club creates through the way that they communicate, the way that they clearly work with their staff, from like the accessibility to the leadership, to the players, to how they impact the community. And then even since, you know, all of the things that they've done with the memorial is so far ingrained in that culture. They've like recycled all of the flowers and all of those things. Everything's been done with so much thought in mind that it just makes you feel like you're a part of it. But then I suppose if we're somebody's sitting listening to this thinking, oh my goodness, my business is lacking culture, or maybe it's non-existent, what about if it's toxic? Where should somebody start in trying to change that?
Football clubs are a really interesting analogy. I have to admit to being an Arsenal fan, so I should say that first. But no, that's fine. Diogo Jota was a great player, and you see that clash actually in football clubs. You see all the stuff around the money going into it. Is this poisoning it? The commercial model, and then you realise what a football club represents is so heartfelt that you might feel moved for days by things that are going on there and the representation of community. So to return to your question about how to be, you know, an organisation that seems to be dying or has lost that or it's toxic, I'd say go back to purpose. So let me give an example. I did a big piece of work for a really interesting place, without being too specific. They produce huge maritime vessels. And some of the, you know, there was aggro between the trade unions and the manual workers and the professional engineers and some of the people in the offices and stuff like that. And we were looking at the employee value proposition, I think is the HRE term for it, but what attracts people to work here. And we came upon pride in the product. Basically, the whole town, every time these vessels take a long time to make, every time one of them gets launched, not just the people from the plant, but the entire town comes out and watches it. Royalty will often appear. You know, that is such a big deal. You know, I think we went quite a long way after that. They had to increase their workforce from 3,000 to 7,000. And we keyed into that. You don't have to get, I mean, they're over 100 years old, the shipyard, and you can get old footage, you know, Pathé News and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it's a big thing and generations can talk about it. And there's man and boy there. There's even sort of three generations of people in the shipyard. And it's like, that's how I think you start to get back to purpose, because we say, why do we work here? And that can bind the chief exec to the new apprentice. You know, they can both say, hey, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? That fought in World War II, or that kind of was like. So I think that's part of the answer. Key back into shared purpose.
I think we all buy into this on an individual level, right? And yet we also all see every day evidence of organizations making choices that are clearly in service of shareholders and commercial returns versus their purpose. They might have a stated purpose, but at the end of the day, when the rubber hits the road, they might be making decisions that are not consistent with that purpose. So how do living organizations balance that human liberation with the kind of commercial pressures of organizations today, particularly when we look at the really influential ones, you know, the big tech companies and those that are having a significant impact on the world at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, is it interesting? These a question, when I did the book launch at London School of Economics, somebody framed a very similar question. And it's almost the premise of the question is, well, it's really nice to have purpose, but let's face it, we've got to make money. So doesn't all that fluffy stuff go away? Dare I say, I think it's a flawed question. One of my favorite books is Built to Last by Colin Zipporas, which is a research of long-lasting, outstanding performance companies who've sustained shareholder success over the long term, like over 25 years on the S&P 500. And one of the characteristics of them is they're purposeful. In fact, if we serve, you know, some of the examples I can think of where I thought this place is not quite killing me, but it's drawing the life out of me, is because they are so worried about the next quarter. If you're sucking too much money out to the shareholders, you're not investing in it, you're actually killing the thing. It's like a runner, you know, if we're a runner that just constantly pushes themselves and pushes themselves and pushes themselves and never has a day off or eat some good food or, you know, takes a holiday or something like that, they will just keel over and they won't be, take footballers, Daniela. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, they need a rest, and people complain about the length of the season these days. It's just too much for them. So I, far from thinking it's in conflict, I think properly understood, and that properly understood is important. It's not purpose over profitability. So it's like purpose leads profitability rather than the other way around. Because if you pursue profitability, you are just like the runner who never has a rest.
Why do you think people are prone to do that? Because it certainly seems they are. And you make a very good case for purpose actually being something that is more commercially sustainable than not. But clearly people make short-term commercial decisions all the time. And why do you think they fall victim to that thinking?
Well, I don't know what the latest figures are for the average tenure of a CEO, but they're not that long. Right. I know in the NHS, for instance, it was getting down to 2 or 3 years, something like that. So one of the things to say is leadership isn't around always that long. So, you know, you see it with prime ministers.
Yeah.
Then, particularly the last government, they weren't around for very long, were they? So they're busy trying to make a name for themselves.
Sure.
Which means the long-term thinking, it's a bit like the exercise analogy. We all know that we should build up to it, but we don't want to go through the pain of it. And there are a lot of actually relational short-term pressures, which is, hey, you know, we're not making that much profit. Our share price has gone down. So I think it is harder in a publicly quoted company than maybe a partnership, for instance, or a family-owned company. Sometimes, doesn't have to be, but sometimes. So I think you sometimes have to make that case for it.
In addition to purpose, you talk about culture, capabilities, and structure as being the other elements of a unique identity expressed through a living organization. Can you talk a little bit about those three as well?
Yeah. I mean, if you think about capability, what's Amazon great at? You know, it's like, go onto your Amazon page. What is it? You like, one thing I'd say, you know, one of their great capabilities is that customer interface. It's like, well, you like reading Alive by Paul Lambert. You might also like Built to Last by Colin Zipporas. It kind of, it starts to get to know you. that's a unique capability. Just like I was talking about my friend Dave, who's just a fabulous coach. He has some unique capabilities that lend themselves to that. Amazon, a great supply chain, you know. I mean, it's ridiculous how fast you can get some of the stuff, isn't it? It's, you know, you're ordering it and next thing somebody's knocking at the door. The way they know customers and that technical innovation, are you going to have a drone delivering it next or whatever? So I think, you know, this is quite an interesting analogy. It's like I did a talk for a bunch of sixth formers in a school recently, and I was trying to articulate to them future of careers. You know, they wanted to know. And I said, well, careers have changed. They've changed because my dad used had a well laid out career path. I had less, but you're going to have even less. But find out what you're great at, what you're passionate about, and what you're really capable at. I mean, we all start off, you know, we're collecting our A-levels and degrees and stuff like that. But I think often the capability, the things that we're great at, I'm pretty good at getting people to be clear about direction or a vision and getting them going, getting them moving around that. Other people are sort of great at seeing potential. Other people are great at drawing ideas together. You know, I think organizations and people, the more they can know themselves, the more they can build on that strength. And I think it's, you know, it's hard enough with just us, isn't it? You know, finding out what we're great at, especially when my daughters, they're sort of 18, 19. But then actually finding out what an organization is uniquely good at and really sticking to it. So that's the capability thing. I think you asked about structures as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting how work's changing. You know, the title of this is Work is Weird. Well, you know, things are breaking down. Well, I started off working for IBM, you know, and at the time IBM was highly bureaucratic, you know, I don't know, 11 layers up to the CEO from me, you know, a graduate employee. Now I work for myself, but I've got four associates working for me, and I'm in a network of other consultancies, and we go to market together on certain things. We have this kind of very different way of structuring. I talk in the towards the end of the book about organizations as ecosystems and how they work together. I think, you know, Uber, Airbnb have shown us that businesses can be platforms where, you know, they don't actually own the assets at all. So I think structure is a moving feast, and we have to find out how to make that more sort of more living. And if you look at it, I talk in the book, I talk about the seven characteristics of a living organization, which parallel seven biological characteristics. And, you know, all people, biological organisms are based around cells. I think actually, if you start to think about that in terms of an organization, what's the cell? You know, there's, it might be your team of seven or 10. And so many more organizations are thinking about how do we get teams that have a lot more autonomy. You know, my friend Emmanuel Quintarelli in Italy is working with an Italian canning firm, but he's taken quite a traditional manufacturing firm, or he's helped them to break it up into mini factories. So they work in sort of teams, and they work, and the productivity's gone up. They've broken it down as they feel a lot more control, a lot more autonomy, the ability to improve their bit of the factory and work with each other. So I think structure is, people started to realize structure should be more living, biological, organic.
Is there anything that you would just retire about organizations right now? If you could wave a magic wand and just eliminate a handful of things that you think are getting in the way of organizations' ability to thrive in the modern context, what would you dash with your wand?
The first thing that came to mind was egotistic or narcissistic leadership, thinking that somehow,
good luck with that.
Yes, I know that somehow being at the top of this makes you the all-seeing brain. I think to be less tongue-in-cheek, maybe it's just the idea that it's only the people at the top who know what's right, and the workers just do. You know, it's, I think in academic speak, it's Taylorism that just says, you know, we'll specify the job, you do it. And I think we need to retire the concept that, like, workers can't think, which is kind of, we hate to say it, but it's, you know, when we write very tight job specs and say, do A all day long, we are kind of saying that to them.
Yeah.
So that would definitely be one. I would also retire the idea that, you know, cost cutting, pure cost cutting is a way to make organizations better. You sometimes have to cut costs, don't think, is that? But, you know, people need to belong somewhere. Right. And if you cut the sandwiches, free sandwiches on a training course and little things like that, it's amazing how much it gets on people's nerves because it's the little things. Our organization never used to do that. They used to, you know, just give us little free things or give us a break or have a company day out. You know, if we believe the future of work is human, we've got to treat it like, you know, the workplace, like it's a place that we have to cultivate rather than just build. That we have to continually make it an environment in which people grow.
Absolutely. And it's funny when you say the little things, when somebody exits a business, it's always something little that's almost, not always, but yeah, a lot of the times it's just been a small domino that's knocked a load of other small dominoes over. Yeah. It's never not. Can be one big event, but sometimes, most of the time you hear it's the opposite. Contentious question potentially, but is hybrid working killing culture? It's, you know, it's, we hear all the time that we need people back in the office, we need them face to face, etc. What's your thoughts on the world of hybrid?
It's community is the answer. I think, how do you sustain a community? I mean, if you think, reflect on the communities that you're part of, you might be part of social media communities, you might be part of social clubs, you might be part of work communities. What's enough to sustain it? So I think it, I have mixed feelings about the phrase hybrid, because I think I quote friends who talk about much more about the idea of kind of lifestyle, you know, kind of how do we create encompass people's lifestyles? So some people need to be home to look after their kids or whatever as part of that. But they also need, a workplace needs a sense of culture, community. So maybe, you know, the ways we sustain that might be we all come in on a Tuesday. It might be simple as that. Or we have some regular sort of social stuff together. Or we deliberately, or we find ways of cultivating that. Maybe we, in different parts of the country, I certainly would try and find some face-to-face time and find a rhythm of that. But I'd also find other ways to cultivate community. It doesn't always have to be face-to-face, but I don't think you can do it without it. So is hybrid work killing it? Well, there were plenty of places like that big office that my friend Mark was in, where he looked across at 800 people and they're all in the same office. Yeah. They weren't talking to each other. They didn't know each other's names. It was a dying place. Mm. So just the fact that you're together doesn't make it a happy little community.
No, absolutely.
So the end of the title of your book is In a Digital Age. So Cultivating Living Organizations for Success in a Digital Age. Why is this approach to looking at organizations and thinking about them as being living organisms so vital right now in the context we currently find ourselves in?
Everybody's looking for wisdom with AI, aren't they? They're kind of saying, is it going to take over? You know, are the robots going to invade my house? They're going to... they're going to write their own code and build their own robot and sort of take over the planet. And I don't personally, I think what we're looking for is a world in which, in that technology, we're trying to find a way that it will improve life, it will improve productivity, it'll improve effectiveness, etc. And the vast majority of that is augmenting human capability. So, I mean, I think I say it's like, yeah, I've got a quote from the book here. Technology should serve the human purpose of the organization, not replace it. Otherwise, we risk building faster machines for going in the wrong direction. Mm. And it's, I think that, you know, it offers huge amount of potential. It can take a lot of the drudgery, the technology out of it. But we have to find ways and means for, you know, that integration, that augmentation a lot of the time, and understanding where, you know, the opportunity of it as well. You know, it's like there are new jobs. We have to watch it as well, because, you know, there's a lot of evidence that it might just hole out the graduate market because the entry jobs are being done by AI. So where do our kids go and get their skills from? Where do they get their basic training from?
I mean,
I hope I answered your question.
Yeah,
there, by
yeah.
the way.
that takes me back to what you mentioned before, which is that you said, you know, if we all buy into the idea that the future of the organization is human, and then you continued on, do you believe that the future of the organization is human?
Yes. Clearly, I guess I wouldn't have written the book, but not without caveats in that I think actually this was investigated very well in Gary Hamel and Michelle Tahili's book, Humanocracy, as well. I said about narcissistic CEOs, the future is human, but we have to cultivate, I mean, to a certain extent, bad behavior and the things that aren't human kill themselves in time. But I'd rather less experiments in bad leadership and more experiments in good leadership. So let's learn the lessons. So the future is human, but let's not take too many dips into it not being human and shoot ourselves in the foot, because I think all the evidence is it's much more productive, it's much happier, it's much more satisfying, it's much more purposeful, and it's much more like the world I think we all want to live in.
Right. So if I'm a leader of an organization listening to this, what are two or three practical things that I could start doing tomorrow to make my organization more alive and less constraining of my people?
I'd say first, ask your colleagues, ask your employees, why did you come to work here? What is it? What is it you love about this place? You might also ask them, what do you hate about this place while you're at it? What could we do to improve that? But what, you know, what is it? What is it that brings you here? And yeah, probably also, and how can we do more of that and less of the things that are getting in the way? How do we get the things out of the way? So I think it's sort of discovering that purpose. Secondly, it's a lot about how can I create environments and structures that allow people to exercise autonomy, to learn? How do I empower people to do better what they're, in their part of the organization they're responsible for? How do I give them freedom for some human creativity? And that doesn't mean chaos. It doesn't mean you have to do 20% time where they go and innovate and get bored the other 80% of the time. It means that you just create your job here, like the mini factories in my friend's example is to make widgets. Make lots of widgets, please. But if you can think of ways to make them better, here you are, we're going to give you enough resources to have a go at that. We're going to give you not people who can just operate it, but people who can design a bit, or you give you some skills to design it a bit. You know, there's a concept in the book of, you know, is every our whole work team, so that can they plan to and improve their work? So if you give that empowerment to people, so I guess that's the second theme. Find purpose. Secondly, empower people through the idea of whole work teams. What else would I include? I'm just looking down my own principles here. It's like I would also kind of create the ability to how do we embed lifelong learning? And so first of all, find out what capabilities or what are we great at? How do we concentrate on that? And how do we get better? So what do we put in place to, you know, traditionally it was the learning and development department. I think it goes well beyond that. It goes, how do we allow people to both improve their work, but also draw on the resources? If they say they need something, you know, how can we make it a resource-rich environment in which they can say, at least justify they need that training or that development, or they can make that investment or do that experiment, a learning organization in which they can keep and they can feed it to others. So there's communication, connection with other groups.
Mm. Yeah, that's good. You've named a couple of companies that you have worked with that you've seen good examples of how purpose come to life. Are there any other real paragons of this type of thinking that leaders could look to as sort of examples of what happens when they get it right?
Well, there's a few poster childs, as you probably know, like Bertzorg, which, you know, the health kind of network where they organize around community teams, self-directed community teams, where they will look at the community needs. They started in the Netherlands. And each one of these community teams, there's several hundred of them now. I talk about it in one of the early chapters of the book, which is a great example. The NHS is adopting some of this so there's a team who kind of signed out what are the health needs this elderly group or this community group or whatever, and organize the team around it. So they have a lot of empowerment, a very small center, and they have much better productivity, as you know, and better health outcomes. So they're a lovely example. A real poster child is Hire, which is pretty well the biggest white goods firm in the world now, which is organized around mini enterprises, micro enterprises linked together. So much more of a networked organization. But I give examples. I mean, I worked in Intrepid, was an example where they've kind of done this as a sort of network-based, built partnerships with communities. When I did work at Nissan, actually, up in Sunderland, there was quite a lot of kind of really good practices then based on more traditional things like Kaizen and Six Sigma, and but giving teams the ability to kind of improve their part of the work process. Single status. We all had these little blue uniforms with our name in, but it was like everybody, that sense of being in teams. There were little hit squads that would go down and kind of improve bits. We'd work together. So I think we see examples of it all over the place. I'm working with a law firm at the moment, a London law firm, who are really hot on this. You know, they are help other organizations bring ideas to life. They work a lot with creative industries and digital firms and the like. But they've cultivated an internal atmosphere, which is as creative as the clients they work with. And they've done that through, getting quite singles, low difference in status. The managing partners are really open, or the facilities, whether you're a staff member, a client, whatever, lovely facilities where you come and sit and you talk and together, a real kind of communal culture, a way of making decisions together, a lot of support for innovation and ideas, and they just won Law Firm of the Year. It works. I believe it works, but there's still problems about scaling it. You know, Hire is now, the example I gave is now 50, 60,000 people. So it's a real, I think it's that big. It's certainly into the tens of thousands. And, you know, that's a challenge. That's the challenge. Because it's easy to do it in a startup. It's not so easy to do it when you get into the thousands.
And is that because, you know, at that scale, you might have a good understanding of what you're good at. And to some extent, that is your sort of your flag in the ground or your North Star or whatever. And you're sort of around that. But also you need to be able to be adaptable. You need to incorporate new skills, new talent, new capabilities. So everything's happening so quickly that you have to be careful that you're close to the flag, but not sort of deviating too far from it and not holding yourself too close to something like that. I think maybe my analogy is not quite working. But
No. I like it. It's this constant tension between creativity and control. What you sort of see, it's a tension. It's more than an analogy. It's a sort of life cycle model of organization. I talk about growing up, startups like a baby, full of potential, but sort of throwing itself everywhere, and you know, being super creative. But you can't be a baby and be 6 foot tall. It'd be a mess. But what you can. So you have to go through those stages of maturity and you have to learn new skills. So, you know, to be a purposeful, well-rounded adult, there's an awful lot of training gone in there to work out what you're good at and what you're not good at and who to work with and how to work with it. Organizations need to go through that journey as well. And it would be it would be hard to summarize a whole chapter on that, but that's the kind of essence.
But yeah, we also wouldn't expect that person to remain the same all through their lives. They're going to be influenced by the context and different people that, you know, touch them throughout the course of their lives. And so we would expect them to adapt and evolve in response to those things as well.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point, by the way. I completely agree with you. But look at what organizations, as a consultant of many years, the number of organizations go, what's the best practice? And what they're saying is, there's one best way to do this. How do I do it? How does Nissan, how does X do it? Well, okay, well, your little bespoke classic car firm in the Malverns, you know, do B Morgan or something like that. You're not like them. Be yourself.
Yeah.
You know, because we've got this organization's machine idea in our head, we go, look, here's the blueprint for a perfect car firm. Let's get it out. And it doesn't work.
I'm really intrigued. What did the six formers say? What was their take on this?
Well, First of all, I was quite impressed with a lot of them. So it was more than 2 weeks ago. It was 3 or 4 years ago, but it was, I turned up, my friend's the headmaster of this school, and he took me on a little tour around, and I bumped, and he introduced me to a few of the sixth formers. I just sort of said, well, tell me about yourself. And a lot of them, first of all, I think we're in a more emotionally enlightened age than my parents' age and my grandparents' age. So they were rather more aware of kind of like, well, the world's changing. But one of them said, I just love designing things. I mean, in a slightly cliched way, you could see they'd be a great engineer. And they said, I did a kind of thing during my holidays, and I did a bit of work for this firm, or kind of like of my friend's firm. And I go, well, you're onto something there, aren't you? You found out what you're good at. So actually the first bit of, or at one point in the talk, they gave me an hour, and it was like, how do I fill a whole hour? But I interviewed three or four of them, and got them to say some of the things they just said, because they already had strong clues about what they loved. That's why I encourage, my daughter's changed her course at university, and she thought, oh, this is not good. And I said, it's absolutely brilliant.
Great.
Absolutely fantastic. You've found out, you've done some learning. But I think I'm intrigued by the people who feel stuck, because I suspect they've been in workplace, either personally, it's either an inner thing, they're slightly fearful about changing, will I have a paycheck, what if I go out on my own, what if I follow my vision. It's scary. It can be scary, and fear holds us back, or it can be the constraint of the organisation. It goes, all right, you know, Alice, don't try that. You know, there's rules against that. There's rules against being creative around this place. And it's like, you know, it's how do we, to liberate, we have to have, I think Amy Edmondson would call it psychological safety. We have to be able to say there's room to experiment, there's room to ask the questions. And we can give that as, not just as organizational leaders, but parents. In fact, I'm toying with the idea that leaders might be better to see themselves as almost, not in a paternalistic way, but corporate parents. Then it would change the nature of leadership, because they'll say, do I know my people? How well am I understanding the potential that's there, the diversity? I know there's another thing you've visited in the series. I think, you know, you've got to know your people. Mm. You've got to know your people to do release it as well.
Yeah. So for people who are not in leadership roles, what is within their power to create more life and freedom in their little corners of the organization?
Try doing something different. I don't mean leaving your job. Well, it might be leaving your job, but I just try pushing the boundary a bit, or experimenting. First of all, I think many managers and supervisors would be delighted if you said, you know, Charlie, I think there's a better way of doing this. Do you mind if we have a go, and try and convince them? So create a bit of space in the environment. Don't just go and say, put me on a training course or spend more money on me. Actually come up with an idea that will push you and create some value in the organization as well as extending you. So I think it's, you know, experiment. Jeff Bezos of Amazon says, has got this little phrase about, if my organization isn't growing fast enough, it's because I'm not doing enough experiments. So I think about that as a personal level. How many experiments am I doing? Have I tried doing something different? You know, even in your personal life, it's like, I always walk that way to work, but how about I walk a different way? See a different view, talk to a different person, expand my horizon a little bit.
Which is also creativity. It goes back to that. We had a last week's episode was on creativity, and people go, creativity, designer or artist, or, you know, it's so, you know, it's not, it's just little incremental changes, or just like you say, small things, try something different. And then that becomes comfortable with change and being creative. And, oh, you know, that's, feels
and
good.
And also getting away from the comfort, right? So feeling uncomfortable on purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul, how can people learn more about what you do, get in touch with you, get the book? Assume Amazon is a good source for the book. Where else can they find you?
So if they want it off Amazon, if they just type in Alive Paul Lambert, they'll find the book. And people in the States, it'll be released in about a week and a half, but everybody else can get it at the moment. That will be the States, Canada. For some reason, Germany on Amazon.de is showing the American release date, but I'm sure you can get it there as well. If they want to get also in touch, so I run Living Work Consulting. So if you just go to livingworkconsulting.com, there's how to get in contact with me there and a little bit more about approach. And I'm sure you can find me on LinkedIn, Paul Lambert, teacher at Headley Business School and run Living Work Consulting. Yeah, and I'd love to continue the conversation.
Great. Fantastic. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you. Really interesting.
Thanks, Paul.